Hi, this is Mary Travers, and you're listening to Mary Travers and Friend. And today's guest is Bob Dylan. We're here in the studio with Bob, and there are a lot of good musical questions to talk about. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the folks that the two of us were listening to in the early 60s. People like Woody Guthrie. And let's open, if we may, with a song you wrote about Woody Guthrie.
I'm out here 1,000 miles from my home.
And now let's play the real Woody Guthrie, shall we?
It's a mighty hard road that my poor hand is told.
What about Guthrie? Did you ever meet him?
Yes, I did. I met him.
Was he very sick then?
Or he was. I did meet him in his, in his prime time, I guess. But when I met him, he was. He had that. He was pretty laid up. But he was still alive and alert. I made many visits out to see him in the hospital.
Right, he had Huntington's chorea, which is
kind of a shaky thing, you know.
This is Mary Travers, and I'll be right back after this message with Bob Dylan. You've done an album that isn't released yet called Basement Tapes. Want to tell me about that?
That was recorded in 66, 67 up in Woodstock, before Woodstock, before the big Woodstock Festival, before Woodstock was discovered, exploited. We were just all up there sort of drying out.
You and the band?
Yeah, members of the band and various other people up there making music and planting gardens and just watching time go by. So in the meantime, we made this record. It wasn't a record. It was just songs which we'd come, to this basement and record out in the woods. That's basically it, really. The record's been exposed throughout the years, so somebody mentioned it was a good idea to put it out, as a record, so people could hear it, in its entirety and just exactly what we were doing up there in those years, and it'll be out shortly.
You want to play a track off of it?
We can play all the tracks.
Okay, let's play one track now and play some more later. Think that period was a good period to hang out and kind of relax and get back to what music was about for you?
For me?
Well,
what do you mean?
In the sense that when you're on tour and you're working hard, I write poetry. I don't write songs. I find it very difficult to write on the road. Between getting on and off a plane and bad food and checking in the Holiday Inn, it leaves you it saps you of the kind of contemplative time you need to sit around and really think. And you also don't play so much together.
Yeah, well, these songs basically on that tape, they were written like in 5-10 minutes. We had just come off of a ferocious tour, Australia and Europe, England.
These were more
needed,
fun.
Needed some time, to let it all, let the dust settle and the waves come in,
Well, I think a lot of people go through periods like that. They need to have. If you forget how to have fun with music, you've just destroyed it for yourself. You know, I think, unfortunately, that's what heavy touring often does to us all. You know, it becomes a job. It
becomes a business.
And perhaps that's kind of the genesis of the Basement Tapes, is to go back and have fun with music. Let's play another track from that.
One, two.
This is Mary Travers, and we'll be right back after this message. In a sense, this is a kind of a retrospective album for you. And you've had some funny albums in the sense that, well, I take that back, not funny albums, but most people do albums because the record company says you got to do X number of albums a year. And then when you get tired, or I get tired, and it's happened to me too, you throw out a best of and kind of hang around and try to figure out what it is you really want to say musically. Are you thinking of doing
another
album?
I just play, you know, I play and whatever comes out, comes out. I don't plan albums. All that pressure is off. I don't have to go in and make an album every 6 months. I don't think of it that way. I just continue to play my guitar, and if there's a song to be, that's in my heart to do, I'll do.
Let's maybe go back to Guthrie and see if we can't explore that a little bit more. He obviously had a great, effect on your music, and on a great many writers of that period, and you can see his influence even now. I mean, the talking blues form, I think, is a very viable and will always be viable form of saying something. And he wrote songs like Pastures of Plenty and This Land Is Your Land. Those songs, most
mm-hmm.
people know.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many songs that are not as familiar. But he was also a very social writer and cared very much, and came from a time of when many artists were very involved in caring about the country and what was happening to it. And I suppose Peter Paul and Mary and Pete Seeger and the Weavers and yourself even were caught up in that social commentary way of talking and of viewing the world as we saw it at that time. There were certainly a lot of your songs that were like that. Do you feel that that's not a reasonable position to take now, or is it just that you're caring about other things?
No, it's a very reasonable position to take now. It's just it's just hard to be specific about, what we're even talking about here, let alone try to, write a song or do a play or make some kind of art form out of these big situations which are happening in the world, which are changing so fast now, from day to day. I mean, it's like, they're just rolling over too fast to keep your finger on, keep your eye on. Whereas back then when Woody was doing all his writing, things... The communications wasn't so, the media wasn't so powerful.
And it also took longer to get something changed.
Took longer to get anywhere. It took longer to get from here to there.
I guess what you're saying really is that it presents a special kind of problem for people who want to write that kind of material.
Well, it can be confusing, if you want to write what they call tropical songs. It's hard to find the frontier.
You wrote a lot of good topical songs, of course.
I wrote those songs though before it was happening, and before it's happening and you do it, it's before everybody's on your case.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets on your case. You just don't want to do it anymore. It's like anything else. People tell you what to do. You don't want me to do what you're told to do. It's discouraging.
Yeah, I noticed.
Plus, you're just running over the same
Same ground.
Yeah.
I mean, you've said it. I mean, I don't think you have to say times are changing twice.
Right. Say it again. Say it again. You know, that's what they want. You know.
Yeah, what they want. This is Mary Travers, and I'll be right back after this message with Bob Dylan. Did you ever meet Nina Simone?
I met her at a table once somewhere. In the club.
Yeah, she did a couple of your tunes.
Yeah.
And well, I thought.
Yeah.
I thought she brought something.
Roberta Flack did Just Like a Woman.
Yeah.
But she got the words wrong, you know.
She changed the words.
I don't think she changed them. I think she just got them wrong.
Well, I know Nina Simone did Just Like a Woman as well.
Yeah?
I think she makes a lyric change there.
Yeah. Personally, I don't understand why anybody would want to do that song, except me.
Richie Havens did it?
Richie, yeah. It made sense coming from Richie.
Let's play Richie.
Yeah.
I like Richie. That when you say, I like Richie, that's not true.
It's an understatement, yeah.
Yeah, I love his work. I love him as a human being.
Yeah.
I love him as a musician.
And he's like a king.
Talk about the present, since we can't talk about the future, since it doesn't exist yet. And the future right now is this basement.
Well, it all exists, you know. The present exists, the past exists, and the future exists. It all exists.
How do you see the future as existing?
It exists as part of the present.
In the sense that
it's connected. Just depends how far you want to set your sights, you know. I mean, you could be very limited in, you know. The Zen philosophy, I think it's Zen philosophy. I mean, you just live in the present, you know. But that's more complicated. That statement is more complicated than meets the eye, really. Or meets the ear. But it's all the same. The past, the present, and the future.
Historically, it would seem so.
I think we might be crossing a line here that...
Okay, we'll drop that.
I don't know if we're the right people to...
Well, know, we are
be
the
talking
right.
about
we
it.
Are
maybe
the right.
Maybe you should be talking about it with somebody else, I should be talking about it with somebody else, or maybe neither one of us should be talking about it.
Okay, that's fine. Those questions are philosophic questions. And the program really isn't about philosophy, per se.
Right.
It's about music. And although there's a lot of philosophy, certainly in music. And a lot in yours, which is self-evident.
That philosophy in my music, I have to admit, is accidental. You know?
You think so?
Yeah, none of it is really preconceived. I can tell you that much.
Well, when you say preconceived, now I know when I write something, when I write a poem, I don't sit around all day saying, gee, I'd like to write a poem about flowers, you know, whatever, or children, or caring about people. I mean, I don't think about what it is I'm going to write about. I mean, when you feel like writing, you sit down and out something pops. But it doesn't mean that you haven't been thinking about it. It means you haven't been consciously thinking about it.
Well, that's thinking. Yeah, that gets back to thinking again, you know. My stuff is more has to do more with feeling than thinking.
Okay.
When I get to thinking, I usually I'm usually in some kind of trouble, and.
Well, feeling is often, if you can trust your own feelings, you're probably in better shape. Is it more truthful?
Oh, yeah. Well, comes down to mutual trust.
Yeah, always. On Blood on the Tracks, I have to tell you that, needless to say, I love the album. I really enjoyed the album. And felt that you... It was funny because when we had talked before, we talked about...
Yeah.
Recording processes and how that when they get very complex, much of the truth of a piece of music is lost. It becomes something else.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I enjoyed about Blood on the Tracks as an album was that it was very simple.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, that's the way things are, really. They are basically very simple. But a lot of people tell me they enjoyed that album. It's hard for me to relate to that. I mean, you know, people enjoying the type of pain, you know?
It is a painful album.
So,
Well, perhaps maybe the word enjoy is the wrong word. Maybe a better word is to say that you're moved. I was moved by the album. You know, there were things that I could relate to in that album that
good.
Made sense to me. You made sense to me on that album. I felt that it was a much more... Well, for me, I felt it was much more first person as opposed to third person.
Well, it makes it more clearly defined, but it still doesn't necessarily make it any better than doing it, because you can do it in second, third, fourth person, too. You know, it's all the same. Sure it is. I know what you mean, though.
Yeah, let's play If You See Her, Say Hello, because I think that's a very beautiful song.
Very pertinent.
For me, that there was... It was a very poignant song.
Mm-hmm.
And a very sad song. But together. I mean, it wasn't... I think maybe what one of the things I like about your work is that even when you're feeling bad, it isn't self-pity bad. It's just, I don't feel good.
Mm-hmm. Even when you're feeling down, you feel up.
Well, you're feeling something, and that's the positive, as opposed to feeling destroyed by it.
Mm-hmm. Do you write songs?
No. I'm writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
I write a lot of poetry. But somehow I've never been able to figure out how to make poems into songs. It's just... It really seems to be a different way of writing.
Yeah, it's confining.
What, songs?
Mm-hmm.
Well, poetry seems to give you a bigger canvas to play with, and you don't have to explain it the same way. Songs seem to have to be understandable. Somehow in a poem you can ramble and deal with several thoughts and not have to necessarily connect them, the images. I know a song of yours that I think for me was most poem-like was Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, because it really wasn't a song, it was a series of images, and when you see it on a piece of paper it really looked like a poem.
Play Leon's version, he did it too.
Okay. The In Concert album that you did with the band on the last tour, which was an incredible piece of business for someone who doesn't do a lot of concerts. You sure made up for it with that tour.
Mm.
I'd like to play something off of that album.
Mm-hmm.
Was there something that you felt went well?
Oh, you play All Along the Watchtower.
Let's finish up with a track from the Basement Tapes. Your choice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, Apple Suckling Tree.
Okay, we'll finish with that.
Yeah.
And thank you. thank you very much. You've been listening to Mary Travers and Friend, and please join us next week.
Matt Damsker is a writer, contemporary music critic, entertainment writer for the Philadelphia Evening and Sunday Bulletin. And Matt Damsker was the gentleman who interviewed Bob Dylan up in Maine just a few weeks ago. Matt, I think the Q people out there would like to know some details of the interview. When exactly was it? Where was it? Were you alone with Dylan? How did you feel about the whole thing? And what frame of mind did you find Dylan?
Yeah, well, it took place September 15th, the afternoon of the first show of the tour. He would open his tour that evening in Augusta, Maine Civic Center on the campus of the university. And I interviewed him at a hotel, in a motel room, actually. I guess it was his motel suite, about a mile and a half from the concert hall, the Senator Motel. And it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It was Dylan and myself in, as I say, his suite. He had some instruments there. It was a rented piano, I believe, that he was pounding out a what sounded like an upbeat blues song. I heard him as I was approaching the open door.
Were you alone?
Yeah. I was accompanied at first by his press agent, Paul Wasserman, who arranged the whole thing.
Introduced you to him.
Yeah, yeah.
You've been a Dylan fan, or certainly a listener of his music all year, you know.
Yeah. I was greatly influenced, I'd have to say, by Dylan's music in the 1960s.
Was it a bit overwhelming meeting him for the first time and having to sit and, you know, have a conversation, ask questions?
Yeah, it was, actually. It was an interview I always thought would be the prize interview for someone who was covering the rock music of the 60s and 70s. And I never really expected or thought to get it, that I felt that the interviews with Dylan would remain, you know, a pretty rare commodity. And I guess, I don't know, I guess when it happened, it was unreal because...
Right. And I imagine every question, because it's such a rare opportunity, every question has sort of double value. And did you pre-plan any questions?
Yes. Well, I did. I pre-planned a lot of questions. I missed the one question that I would have wanted to ask him, I think, because when he started to open up, he seemed to be pretty honest about himself in a way. That was the question about Reuben Hurricane Carter and his support of him. In light of the fact that the case has sort of had a turnabout.
That's the question that you forgot to ask,
the
right?
The question I didn't ask.
Well, you got a lot of good questions, and we're happy, very happy for the interview. This is, again, September 15th in Augusta, Maine, right before the start of Dylan's tour opening show. Matt Damsker of The Bulletin.
This is a long tour, and it follows a long period of touring. Probably the longest period you've gone through.
No. In the old days, we used to do it more.
Yeah?
Yeah. When I was living at the Chelsea Hotel, we were touring like 8-9 months out of every year. 9 months, that's an awful long time. Mm-hmm. And of course, it meant when I moved to Woodstock, those days were harder to tour back then.
Yeah. Well, what about what's the motivation for all this touring these days?
Well, I just can't think of nothing else I want to do right now.
Really? There's gossipy reports that you need to make some money.
Well, it's true to a certain extent, but money's not everything.
No. With divorce and things like this, there have been heavy gossip items. I guess I'm exploiting you by asking you that.
No, that's quite all right. I've lost a lot of money, but I don't think of it that way.
Yeah. People analyze your stuff very seriously, and I know in reading some of the quotes you've given that you feel sometimes it's taken too seriously. For instance, the way the critics reacted to Ronaldo and Clara.
Well, that I thought was shameful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. First of all, people should find out and decide for themselves whether they like it or not. Mm-hmm. But these critics, what they do bring a certain amount of responsibility that they have, not only to the artist but to the public. And unless they've had the experiences that the artist has had, or can relate to those experiences, then they shouldn't be involved with that artist's work. That's what I feel. Unless they, you know, they're educated in that type of music, or or have lived where that artist has lived,
yes,
and has felt what that artist has felt, then they have really no right to criticize in a negative way anything which they themselves don't quite understand. I mean, there's enough people out there who don't understand it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you always have, I'm just talking about negative critics. There's plenty of positive critics in there too.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine lots of critics take sides, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Same way in theater, I think. Critics just take sides. I mean, people are criticizers of life, you know. If you go over to somebody's house, if you're sitting around at somebody's house, you're always talking. Sometimes, you know, everybody is a critic on some level, on something. But critic it seems, just by the sound of the word, it seems to be a negative thing.
Yes. So a critic is...
Yeah, they're critical.
To
be critical.
To put down. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the opposite of a critic? A supporter.
All right.
So I have plenty of supporters, too, so critics don't bother me.
Supporter doesn't seem like a legitimate... I mean, if somebody can be completely objective, you would think that would be the best stance, but it doesn't seem critics can be completely objective.
Well, they get paid not to be objective.
Under the pretense of objectivity, shall we say.
They're all right. I mean, everybody's got to make a living, you know?
I'm a critic, too, Bob. I've had to criticize your stuff. I mean...
Well, that's fine. I mean, a lot of the things I've done need to be criticized. I agree to that.
Do you find that you have gotten insights from criticism?
No, I don't think so. But I respect a man's right, you know. If you can't identify with something and it's not done his way of thinking, well, he can criticize it, you know.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of things which I criticize myself.
Yeah. I understand you're cutting down Rinaldo and Clara to 2 hours.
That's already a fact, yeah.
Right. I can ask, was it in response to the commercial?
No, it was in response to the theater owners themselves. It wasn't in response to the people, because the people, as I understand, did get something out of it, and will continue to.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a direct action that was done for the theater. Both theater owners. I mean, they just say that they couldn't show the movie. They couldn't get it a fair showing at 4 hours because they could not get people in and out and cost them to open their doors.
Mm-hmm.
Not too much money.
Mm-hmm.
So,
practical matter.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Bob, in viewing the film, there was one scene that really struck me. The scene where you jump out of the tour bus.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
In New York City.
Uh-huh.
And you sort of wander. Now, you seem to get away pretty anonymously. You hand a beggar a bill.
Yeah.
And you sort of hold your hand out as if you're a beggar. And
yeah.
I got an impression of that scene that it sort of represented that you were sort of looking for something that was lost to you. And I began to think that maybe the whole film had something to do with that. It was the question of identity had been lost through public image. And that perhaps the real person inside had become lost to this public person that everyone has created.
I am not what you call a commercial star.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
So you have to remember me in that light all the time. I don't sell records, you know, like Fleetwood Mac sells.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't sell platinum records.
Yeah.
You know? I just don't. And I sell... enough, you know, but I'm not a commercial star in that sense of the word. You know, yes, we sell more records than I would Kiss. You know,
yes,
you can name lots of people. And also, I'm not the type of star that is that assuming. I mean, there's no place I can't go or can't be or can't nothing I can't do.
Mm-hmm.
Just because people might know who I am. I don't live under that barrier.
Yeah. You don't feel that people are you're living the drama that people have created of your life.
Well, no, I feel if I must have created the drama. I don't think other people have.
Do you still see yourself? Or did you ever see yourself as a strong moral voice? Morality is.
Uh huh. Yeah, I have. I've tried to be very moral in all my dealings. In an ultimate sense, I've tried to remain very moral, and even in my sinful ways, I see some morality coming out of the ashes. I can always reason it out in my head in some kind of way.
Uh-huh. we just can't be perfect. And you feel it carries over into the 70s. I mean, there was such an anger and such a, it seems like such a righteous resentment and a consciousness in the 60s, all that was going on, all that was brewing, that you articulated very ambiguously, I suppose. You feel that it's similar in the 70s, or do you feel that everything has changed into more of an entertainment kind of thing? Because back then it did seem to be strongly tied into a message that people hadn't, at least the pop music, the rock and roll music, hadn't been speaking to in the 50s until the folk people came around in the early 60s.
No, it was the Beatles that did that.
Yeah.
The Beatles did that. I mean, we always knew, you know, Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, Johnny Hooker, Buddy Holly. Mm-hmm. You know, we were always in that tradition all the time. I personally went into the folk music thing because it was new to me, and I realized that I didn't have that information, and it still stuck. I mean, it still sticks with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was using a ballad form alongside of, and then a storytelling form. Which that's how I was able to write those songs, because I learned it in the folk circles.
Yeah.
That form. But you can also tell the same story in a blues form, which one step beyond that blues would be rock and roll form. Mm-hmm. But once you get into production, you ain't gonna really tell too much of a story at all, you know. And records nowadays are all, they're all production.
Yeah.
You know?
And you've avoided that in your records.
I haven't. I'm not sure it's good or bad. You know, it's just as bad as good. It's good because it allows me, I've been making records long enough, so I'm confident to go into the studio and just do it without a producer. Because I started recording for John Hammond in 1960. That's the way he made records. Yeah. We'd go in, we'd make a record live.
It's a living thing.
Yeah.
It's recordings of songs, like you said, in that Playboy interview.
That's the way I learned how to record. And that's the way other people were doing it.
Yeah.
Now, you don't do it that way.
Right.
Because machinery is, they got, you know, it's like, you go to a recording studio now, and what I do is obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't even half the time use a decent studio. I mean, we made the last record, we made Street Legal, in a rehearsal hall. You know, and only because we couldn't get a studio booked in town, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could use a good producer, and I could make some well-produced records, because my songs are good enough. I mean, you don't need but a fairly decent song, you know, to have a well-produced record.
Well, it seems that there were, well, I think of one album, New Morning, as the closest thing to like a Dylan pop produced album. That seemed to me, it seemed to have a sort of pastel, if that's the word, texture to it.
Yeah.
And in many ways, it's probably an album that people don't take it seriously.
I don't think they do, but if you listen to that album, you realize I had the girls on there with me too.
Yeah.
A lot of people complain about the girls, you know, I hear this sound that these particular girls make, and then just start background singers.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You'll see the show tonight. You'll see they're not the Iquettes, they're not Barry Manilow's girls, and they're not. They sing in the way these songs should be sung.
Yeah. Well, I guess you feel it just wouldn't be Bob Dylan. It wouldn't be the Bob Dylan style if you went in and did a produced album, you know, with all the overdubs.
Oh, no. At this time, I never had the time to do it.
Oh.
Or the patience, you know. Because we've been on the road now so long. I had 2 weeks to make an album this year.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I had, was 2 weeks. And fortunately, we managed to do it. If I hadn't done that 2 weeks, I wouldn't have had a record out. And then, you know how the way it is. After a certain amount of time, you won't do those songs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you lose them.
I would think, with someone like you, then, if you started to labor over those songs with overdubs, that it would probably kill the purity that you might feel in expressing.
Well, I feel that you can do it both. I haven't done it that way, but I feel that you can go in. See, my records, first of all, they take a week or two to make. Other people, the Eagles go in and make a record, they'll take a year.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Every time they're off the road, they'll go work on it, and that's what they'll be doing. I'm making that record, and it'll be important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And me, I don't do that because I don't have a producer.
How can I tell you?
I mean, you could get any producer you want. I guess
that's
the
right.
impression what you're saying is you don't feel there's a producer you know of that could be that sympathetic.
I'm searching for one right now, as a matter of fact, I'm searching for a qualified record producer. I mean, listen to one of them songs with the Bee Gees. You know, listen to one of those songs, and if you hear the song underneath the song, that's the real song.
Yeah.
But what you listen to in a room or a record player or disco is that live beat and that swell, you know, that what is it kind of thing, you know, it just sounds good. It's like very angelic, and it's got the beat to it, too.
Well, that's an interesting point right there, the concept of disco that has begun to dominate like maybe one whole half of like what people are thinking of pop and rock music in the 70s. And to me, I reflect it as a kind of mechanical, kind of mechanical machine music that's there to sustain a mood and a rhythm. But it seems in opposition to the whole mainstream of 60s music, the stuff you were into and the Beatles stuff.
It is, but its purpose, main purpose, is to make people dance and forget their troubles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and me, we might go down to a bar and listen to a bar band, and you feel like dancing, you can dance, you feel like drinking, you can drink. But these people, they get dressed up and they want to go out and boogie in a sophisticated kind of a way.
Yeah.
And that music allows them to do it, and it's too late to go back because it's all done with machinery, and it's perfectly legitimate. People want to dance, and it creates an environment for them to do it in.
Yeah, but it seems so amoral.
Isn't it?
No, not as the disco music, and there's a decadent sort of amorality to the disco vibe.
They always say that the devil is always involved in dancing. You know, now that one side says that. I personally don't believe it at all, and some of the great religions of the world don't believe it either.
Well, that idea of amorality equated with evil crops up in a book you might have read. I don't know if you have The World According to Gar. It's just out now. John Irving.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
It equates evil, the evil in the world, not as such a mysterious force. It equates it with an absence of morality.
Mm.
You know, keeping faith between people in a marriage, let's say, as the hardest thing to do. In other words, the evil is a force that is simple because it exists. Good is more a human creation. Now, I was trying to equate that perhaps to your music, in which notions of evil and good sort of trade back into the images of good and evil, bad and good, constructive and destructive, sort of trade back and forth with often equal power. And the only thing that overcomes one or supports the other is the personal faith of the singer or the people involved.
But that's always true. I mean, even in the old ballads, singers that used to sing, they used to lay it out, you know, same way, and the singer was the voice, which could decide for you, the listener, you know, which side was right and which side was wrong, if there can be such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't think good and evil's got anything to do with marriage at all. Marriage, when you get into, sometimes you find it's just a job. Being faithful to oneself is more worthy than being faithful to an idea or something which is transient. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It changes all the time.
Yes. It's illusory.
You're always grasping it, you know. You're wondering what you grasp. Well, even when you get a hold of it, you don't have anything.
The anger that I feel in so much of your stuff of the 60s. Resurfacing. I don't feel it so much on, let's say, an album like Street Legal. Except maybe in a couple songs. The Changing the Guard and the No Time to Think.
Well, we put aside the anger for the time being, because the anger doesn't drive. The 60s was a driven time. Driving anger was driving everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what was pushing you, anger. But nowadays, you can't be pushed by that no more. You have to just deal with anger. It's out in front of you, except instead of behind you. It's the way I see it anyway.
Are you bored by rock and roll? Or do you feel that it just would cloud you by making you competitive?
No, I don't know what you mean by rock and roll.
You mentioned it yourself, the Fleetwood Mac stuff.
Well, I don't know if they call it rock and roll. I think maybe that's a pop.
Okay.
Rock and roll.
That's fair.
It's just a 12-bar beat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just backbeat. That's all rock and roll. It's just backbeat. That's all you need to play rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of rock and roll is, you know, is whatever, whatever the subject matter is about. It's got the backbeat, and you can move to it. It makes you feel alive. But for me, I mean, I've never. I used to play rock and roll, if that's what it was called when I was growing up, but I saw these people that have died, you know. Mm-hmm. I've seen Buddy Holly play, I've seen Eddie Cochran play,
yeah.
I've seen Sam Cooke, I've seen all these people that are dead, and not a day goes by when I don't think about all these people.
The death of Elvis,
there's another case.
How did you react?
I was stunned.
Mm-hmm.
Something I never had thought about.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought if anybody else was going to live forever, I saw no reason for his death.
When you survived that motorcycle accident in 66, I guess that was a real brush that brought
a... That was a brush. I survived that, but what I survived after that was even harder to survive than the motorcycle crash. That was just a physical crash.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes the things in life that you cannot see are harder to survive than something which you can pin down.
Could you pin that down a little more for me? I mean, you say what you survived after that.
Well, that crash was like in 1967 or 66.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, I deserved to crash because I certainly couldn't have gone on. It was just something, you know, the Great Spirit telling me, you know, you need a rest.
Mm-hmm.
And but that had nothing to do with me. That crash. After that, I was what I survived after that was man-made.
Your own making.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it humbled you when you crashed.
Well, I don't recall what I was thinking about. I looked at the ceiling for a while. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, John Wesley Harding, maybe I'm wrong in saying, resulted from that.
Well, at that time, I had not recorded for a while. I don't think I might have had a new contract coming up, which I think I did. I didn't know how to record the way other people were recording, and I didn't want to. The Beatles had just released Sgt. Pepper, which I didn't like at all because I could see that it was, talk about indulgence. I thought that was a very indulgent album, although the songs on it were real good. I just didn't think that all that production was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Beatles had never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
The Stones did it too, with something they were doing. Mick had that song out, 10,000 Year Old Man or something like that.
That sort of came after Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah.
Sort of copied.
Okay. And at that time, Janis Joplin was starting to make it big. Jimi Hendrix was starting to make it big. Grateful Dead were making it big. There was a lot of stuff happening that I just didn't quite understand. At that period of time, none of us did.
Yeah,
to be honest with you, we didn't figure that had anything to do with anything. Although Janis was great, Janis was great, but the psychedelic music scene—that's really what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And Jimi Hendrix, what he was doing with his guitar was fine, but then all the producers started to get into everything. And anyway, we were caught. We were up there in Woodstock, so we were laying down songs. And at that period of time, we were laying down all these songs on tape. We were just writing them and singing them onto a tape. And I was going to have to go in and make a record, and I figured, well, is this the kind of stuff I want to do on my record? And I'd sing the songs, and I'd say, I didn't feel right. I mean, I didn't figure it was saying anything different, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Except in my particular type of way it was. But then I went back and just wrote real simple songs. It was the first time I ever did an album, ever wrote a song, as a matter of fact. There's only two songs on the album which came at the same time as the music. The rest of the songs was written out on paper, and I found the tunes for them later. I haven't done it, didn't do it before, and I haven't done it since.
Mm-hmm.
That might account for the specialness of that album.
Yeah.
And, you know, it came out at a time, it was live in the studio.
Yeah.
And I knew it wasn't going to stay there very long, though, but it was special. And I still sing them songs.
Man, they're powerful songs, and it took so long, I mean, because, as I say, I was picking up that album expecting you to, like, have rolled along. Great, but, you know, you sort of went back to the pastoral, a rustic. It wasn't quite folk. It was more, you know, swinging a country, which would solidify with Nashville's uh-huh. skyline.
Right.
And
I hear you. But the thing is, see, I've never broke tradition. I've never mm-hmm. gone and done something that had no tradition behind it.
Yeah.
And when I broke it at John Wesley Harding, I started out again. And I knew it wasn't where I was going to stay very long, but I had to explore all that territory, and never did until I got to Blood on the Tracks did I finally get a hold of what I needed to get a hold of. And once I got a hold of that, Blood on the Tracks wasn't it either, and neither was Desire, but Street Legal comes the closest to where my music is going for the rest of the time. And it has to do with the illusion of time. I mean, what the songs are necessarily about is the illusions of time. Now, in the old days, they used to do it automatically, mm-hmm. but it's like I had amnesia. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, in 1966, I couldn't remember how to do it, and I tried to force learn it, and I couldn't learn what I had been able to do naturally, like Highway 61 Revisited. I mean, you can't sit down and write that consciously.
I guess not.
I mean, because it has to do with the breakup of time. See, and
fragmentation.
Yeah.
Fragmentation is such an important part, I guess, in your mm-hmm. art. I feel that.
You know, it's got, I mean, it just, in the first four lines, it covers all you need to cover. And it covers the past, present, future. I had to go and learn how to do that consciously, because I learned in 75 that I was going to have to do it from now on consciously. And those are the kind of songs I wanted to write. The ones that do have the breakup of time, where there is no time. Try to make the focus as strong as a magnifying glass under the sun,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to do it consciously is a trick, you know. And I did it on that. I did it on Blood on the Tracks for the first time, and I didn't know. I knew how to do it because it was a technique I learned. I actually had a teacher for it, and.
Who was that?
There's an old man in New York who was who knew about that. And so I picked up what I could.
Do you feel that Blood on the Tracks and Desire then were sort of sentimental albums?
We'll come right back to the sentimental albums. I hope.